I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Fishtown is one of the Philadelphia neighborhoods that has undergone a dramatic transformation in recent years. Just outside of Center City, Philadelphia, this area has become a popular place for homeowners and a destination for those looking for good food and drink, arts and culture. Today on Radio Times, a portrait of Fishtown from Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler. Longtime resident Sandy Saltzman, who heads up a local housing and economic development group, tells us about Fishtown then and now. Sandy Smith, editor for Philadelphia Magazine, talks about race. But first, Johnny Brenda's. The bar and restaurant venue is celebrating its 10th year of live music. Liz sat down with William Reed, co-owner of Johnny Brenda's, and Chris Ward, the talent buyer for Johnny Brenda's. William Reed describes the bar's history.
The old bar, it was always called Johnny Brenda's, at least since 1967. But I think their heyday was really in the 70s, judging by the decor and the general shape of the building. Most of the windows have been blocked up to the point where there was just like a 1 foot by 1 foot little window left. And so it was sort of that era of, you know, if you go in a bar, it was almost like a dark secret to be in there and drinking. And that wasn't really what we were going for. Fishtown itself really hadn't seen a new bar that was any different than the shot and beer corner bars that had been there for generations. So Paul and I, our idea was first thing was to open up the building to the outside. And so we reopened all the windows to the original size, took out the cinder block, put in nice big airy windows and stuff like that. I don't know how else to say Fishtown was pretty rough and tumble. It was like there was a lot of cleaning up to do at the property. Many days we would just show up and clean up chicken bones and weird detritus laying all over the sidewalk. I could get more disgusting about that if I wanted to. There was a lot to do. Our vision for the place was that we did want to be sort of like the living room for the neighborhood, and we really wanted to be inviting. So opening up the windows, you know, putting a window in the front door instead of just having a solid slab, things like that kind of went a long way to sort of inviting the neighborhood in to the bar.
You wanted to open it as a local place for the locals to go to, had good food, local beer. How has that changed over the years, and how have you kind of modified what you offer, if you have, as the neighborhood has changed? It's gentrified. People come now from out of town, right? They've heard about Johnny Brenda's. It's this go-to spot. How have you changed to reflect that, or have you?
I think our core mission is pretty much the same as far as the bar or restaurant side of it goes. We do, you know, the food is still, everything's prepared fresh, all that kind of thing. As you mentioned, we do all local beer, which we're really proud of. The biggest change was 2 years into being open when we decided to make live music be a key part of the business. And we decided to expand into the upper floors.
And let's talk about that live music. You're marking the 10th anniversary. Chris, I want to bring you into the conversation. I recently saw Johnny Brenda's referred to as a landmark live music venue. How does that make you feel? Probably pretty good.
It does. It makes me feel great because I've also got to be on that stage a few times. So I had a very interesting experience. Was first time I ever went to Johnny Brenda's, I was performing. And I remember having this kind of out-of-body experience playing a local club in Philadelphia and actually feeling good after getting off stage. Because small venues generally treat bands as if they're just kind of like, get them in the door, get them out the door. And this experience of playing this room and seeing a balcony above you, it was unbelievable. And that got me wanting to work there. And so hearing that just gets me very excited, because I know that even before I was working there, that was the mission, that was the philosophy.
And how do you decide who to book?
Oh, that's a good question. I would say the short answer is I'm looking for good music. Obviously, there's a long answer to that. What is good music? I think I know that I, as well as some of my other workers at Johnny Brenda's, take our cue from kind of the downstairs when it comes to like the local beer and the fresh food is we're looking for something that's unique, something that has a specific voice. Definitely not cover bands. We do book DJs, but when we book DJs, we're looking for DJs that are doing something unique and different, not just someone just spinning whatever. So for instance, we have a party called It's the Year and they go ahead and spin just from 1 year. We find that to be unique, you know, rather than just say, hey, I want to, you know, spin whatever the latest top 40 songs are. And then so with bands, a lot of my relationships around booking bands actually comes from booking agents. So I build relationships with booking agents. They're out there scouring, going to shows, and then they're pitching me their ideas. So if I have a really good a relationship with a booking agent, I'll take a risk. And those risks sometimes pan out, sometimes they don't. Good examples of those risks would be like having Beach House at Johnny Brenda's, and that was before anyone knew who Beach House was. So having those experiences, those long-term relationships with booking agents, then in turn having them with bands.
And you mentioned that you take your cues from downstairs being locally sourced food, local beer, but you have are there local acts who have performed at Johnny Brenda's early on in their career who you kind of hold as like, hey, I introduced that person to the world or to a lot of larger audience?
Yeah, I don't know that we would say specifically we introduced them, but I definitely feel like we were somewhat of a living room for some bands, both downstairs and upstairs. A great example would be, say, like Kurt Vile, The War on Drugs. Those are two great examples of bands that started out at Johnny Brenda's kind of at the same time as Johnny Brenda's was taking off. And they would play and they'd just be like a local band. And then, what was it, 2 years ago, The War on Drugs did a secret show before they went out on a tour playing to, like, you know, 5,000 people a night. And they wanted to specifically do it at Johnny Brenda's because that felt like home to them. Dr. Dog, a newer band right now that's kind of taken off as Hop Along, and we've had them for New Year's Eve. So I'm from a philosophical place around booking, I found that when I was cutting my teeth playing shows here in Philadelphia that I didn't feel like venues really took local bands seriously. They just saw them as calendar fillers. And being a local artist myself, I thought it was really important that we have a mission to give the local bands the same type of treatment that we'd give a national act. And that's super important to myself and all the people that work in the venue.
And Philly obviously has a bunch of live venues, including Johnny Brenda's, and over the years has had them, TLA, Trocadero, Electric Factory. Why is live music important? Why should I come out and go see live music, whether it's at Johnny Brenda's or somewhere else, instead of, you know, after a hard day going home and sitting on my couch and pressing play on the iPod?
I think
William, go ahead.
I'd like to, I'm sure Chris has his answer for that as well. But I think when Paul and I were thinking about the place, going back to Standard Tap for just a second, like I thought about like what caused me to fall in love with some bars. And one thing is food. I mean, it's sort of the, you know, old truism, you know, the way to a man's heart kind of thing, or probably a woman's heart too. It's good food. It sort of definitely makes you remember a place and really draws you to a place. But the other thing is music. I mean, my experiences for myself growing up and being in Philly, you know, my experiences at the Khyber back in the day, as they say, like some shows are just etched in my memory forever. And that's, and it typically is around the music itself. It's such a powerful thing. And, you know, and live original music, you know, not cover bands and blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
Do you feel like the gentrification ball is kind of following you? Johnny Brenda's has, you know, it's still there, but the surrounding area is certainly very different. A couple businesses that have come in from New York. There's at least one wine bar, maybe two.
Two opened in the same month.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So is the gentrification train following you? Or
I definitely have quite a few realtors have asked where our next project is. That's one of their favorite questions for us. I do think it speaks to how like a good bar can really bring a neighborhood together. I guess you could say it's community building. I don't really worry about real estate prices or values that much, but it definitely brings a community together and it really focuses a lot of positive energy if it's a good bar. You know, sometimes it's funny, a lot of city officials look on bars first as a possible nuisance, and our experience is so opposite of that, that it blows our minds. We're like, are you kidding me? And it's like a great bar, as we said, like Johnny Brenda's is sort of the neighborhood living room, you know, for artists, for all kinds of people coming and crossing paths. And for us, it's so natural that that would be the case. And so Yeah. I mean, I like to think that it definitely helped spur along the neighborhood and brought it to where it is.
Through all of this, has it been hard to remain friends with your business partner, Paul Kimport?
That's something I've reflected on a lot over the past few years, just how, especially as Paul and I thought of maybe doing another project and maybe having another partner or something, and we realized just how special the relationship is of just having us both, we're each 50-50 in the buildings, the businesses, everything. Mm. There's certainly times where we've been sick of each other, you know, we've kind of been like, okay, I've seen enough of you, you know, but he's an amazing partner, and we kind of fill each other's blind spots a little bit. I mean, it's a long and close relationship. That it's interesting. If you had three people, no matter what the splits were, you got politics because there's somebody's like a swing vote, you know?
Right. Someone's trying to convince someone else to come to their side.
And with Paul and I, just we got to defend our ideas. If we want to do something, like I'll talk to him about the idea and he'll talk to me. And I think it really works. It's the only the good ideas manage to get through because both of us have to be all on board on it. It's pretty funny. I don't know. It's a great relationship. I mean, honestly, like, don't have a bad thing to say about it.
And you mentioned that real estate agents, jokingly or not, ask you where your next venture is. I hear it's at the old Shenanigans site in Kensington. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Paul and I went into this bar that it's in the next neighborhood north of Fishtown, South Kensington. And I love the bar. And it's right underneath the L. And the whole public perception of what the L means has changed so much, even in just the last 5 years. A lot of people, you know, the L used to be, underneath the L was prostitution and drugs, heroin, mostly crack, that kind of thing. It has changed so much because there's so many people that are part of Philadelphia now, moving to Philadelphia, that don't want to own a car and actually look on the L as a positive thing. Used to be transit-oriented development was a word that only was said by, or a phrase that was only said by, like, urban planners. Mm-hmm. But it's true. People are buying houses close to the L because they don't want to own a car. And so this bar is right underneath the L, and we're really excited to have it. We'll probably change the name. That's about the only thing we're not excited about.
I'm Elizabeth Fiedler. My guests have been William Reed, co-owner of Johnny Brenda's, a bar and restaurant and music venue in Fishtown, and Chris Ward, the talent buyer at Johnny Brenda's. Thank you both so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Also listening to one of the popular local bands that has performed at Johnny Brenda's, The War on Drugs. This is their song called Best Night. Coming up, Fishtown Then and Now with lifelong resident Sandy Saltzman. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Today, we're exploring the Philadelphia neighborhood of Fishtown with Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler. It's now home to a popular dining and bar scene, but not so long ago, it struggled with challenges of abandoned properties and poverty that face many Philadelphia neighborhoods, as we will hear in this interview with a lifelong neighborhood resident.
I'm Elizabeth Fiedler, a producer for Radio Times, and my guest here is Sandy Saltzman, the executive director of the New Kensington Community Development Corporation. For almost 20 years, Sandy's been leading a group that focuses on planning, economic development, and community empowerment in Philadelphia's Fishtown, Kensington, and Port Richmond neighborhoods. Sandy, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Times.
You're welcome.
So you've lived in Fishtown your whole life.
Correct.
What was the neighborhood like when you were growing up?
So when I was growing up, it was always a tight community. However, it was fraying around the edges. So, you know, we were a product of the Industrial Revolution. So there was a lot of factories and textile mills. But by the end of World War II, when the vets were coming back, there were a number of programs and options for them that they didn't need to come back to the neighborhood. And in fact, a lot of the textile mills were already moving south. So a lot of the vets didn't come back to the neighborhood. They were able to move to Levittown and places like that. And our neighborhood started to deteriorate a lot. So by the time I was coming up, we had a lot of vacant properties, some vacant houses, things like that.
And many people consider you to be the unofficial president of Fishtown. When you were a kid, did you ever expect that you would spend your life in Fishtown?
No. Short answer, no. I mean, obviously, I'm fourth generation Fishtowner, so, you know, Fishtown is in my blood. My children live in Fishtown. My granddaughter lives in Fishtown. But no, I never expect it to become the voice of Fishtown. And I don't think of myself as the voice of Fishtown.
And Fishtown, as we were talking about, Fishtown has undergone a really radical transformation in the last 10, 20, 50 years. How did it go from being home to abandoned buildings, trash-strewn vacant lots, to what it is now, this destination with art galleries, urban farms, tons of restaurants, wine bars?
Yeah, everybody seems to feel that this happened overnight, and I can tell you that it didn't. I have been working in the neighborhood since the late 70s, trying to rebuild this neighborhood. And so I think most people that are in community development realize that if a neighborhood takes 50, 60, 70 years to go down, it's almost going to take an equal amount of time for it to rejuvenate itself. So our neighborhood, we started the CDC, the Community Development Corporation, back in 1985. And we started by doing the typical things that CDCs do, which is housing counseling, housing renovation, things of that nature.
And what does housing counseling mean?
Housing counseling is to help people become first-time home buyers. And over the years, it has also changed into working with people that have been in foreclosure. Since the crisis in 2008, we've had a number of people that have had problems with the banks and everything. So that has become really a big part of our program. And then we do housing renovation.
And you started calling, or the NKCDC started calling Frankford Avenue, which is this main road that runs through the neighborhood, started calling it an arts corridor. But you did that even before there were art galleries, cafes, lots of artists. Why?
Well, we could see the trend. We knew that the arts started on South Street and was slowly moving north. It had been in Old City, and it was starting to hit the beginning of Northern Liberties. We were the logical next neighborhood, and so therefore we decided to go to the city and ask to have our neighborhood made an arts corridor before it ever happened. We wanted to do something that was a little different. We wanted the artists to stay here. We recognize that in a lot of the neighborhoods, the artists come and then they get priced out and they can't stay. So we started by meeting with artists and trying to get them interested in the vacant buildings that they could renovate, could get hold of very inexpensively. They could live there. They could rent out an apartment on the third floor and have space for their art on the first floor. And that worked to a degree. I mean, obviously, we didn't get as many as we had hoped for, but there are some artists that will not be squeezed out of our neighborhood. We also took an old abandoned factory, a textile mill, and we turned it into artist live workspace. So it's 27 units of artist live workspace that's low income housing for artists, and it will remain that way for 30 years.
And you mentioned Old City, Northern Liberties, some places in Philadelphia where artists had worked and lived and then were squeezed out, right, as development continued.
Exactly.
Is that what motivated you? Seeing that happen in other parts of the city, that's what motivated you to try to keep them in Fishtown to make that a real structural part of how you rebuilt the town?
It is. I mean, yes, it definitely is. We recognize that artists are change makers, that they will move into neighborhoods that are a little bit sketchy, but not dangerous, and that they will totally turn the neighborhood around. And we wanted that to happen, but we wanted them to stay in our neighborhood. We didn't want them to leave once they had established themselves, because it was important that we have these people in our neighborhood that would continue to make it a vibrant place to live.
And looking back in time as we are, I know there's some relatively long-time businesses that opened early on in the neighborhood's rebirth. Places I'm thinking like Johnny Brenda's Bar and Restaurant, DePinto Guitars, Rocket Cat Cafe. Mm-hmm. How did those early birds serve as anchors to help attract more businesses?
So the Rocket Cat Cafe, interesting enough, is one of the very first ones that moved into the neighborhood. And New Kensington actually bought that building and got Karen and Tom to purchase the building off of us with the understanding that they would make it into a coffee shop. We had no coffee shops. We had no gallery space at this point. And they would turn the second and third floor into artist workspace. So that was actually the very beginnings of the Arts Corridor. Johnny Brenda's has been there now for 10 years, and they have been amazing in bringing the arts, you know, the artists, the music scene to the neighborhood, you know. So now besides them, we have Fillmore East, for goodness sake, you know, and DePinto's, you know, has just been great. I mean, they're an amazing place, you know, and yeah, there's just so many. I mean, it's to me, it's unbelievable. I go away for a couple of weeks and I come back and something new has popped up, you know, that you just like, wow, when did that happen? So, yeah.
So it sounds like most of the change has been for the good, but probably not all of it, I'm guessing.
Well, I mean, I think it's for the most part, it has been for the good. Obviously, we're very concerned about taxes for our senior citizens so that they're able to stay in the neighborhood, because after all, these are people that moved into this neighborhood or inherited a house in this neighborhood or have been in this neighborhood their entire lives. And, you know, in many cases, they bought their house for less than $10,000. And now their houses are being, you know, assessed at $200,000, $300,000, and they're paying almost what they paid for their house in taxes a year.
Wow.
And yeah, it's really pretty incredible. And, you know, in some cases they can afford it, but people that are living just on Social Security, they're not able to afford it, and they have to sell their homes. And while people say, oh, well, that's not a bad thing, look at how much money they can sell their home for. When you're 70, 80 years old and you've lived in a place all of your life, you raised your family there, you don't want to have to go and find another place to live. It becomes really difficult, you know, and to not be able to stay there because you can't afford to pay the taxes seems to me to be a crime. And the city has tried. I mean, they have done the homestead, you know, they have a senior citizen freeze. But if you don't get in early enough, you don't get to take advantage of it. And that becomes really difficult.
And you bought your home in Fishtown for $7,500 40 years ago. And now there are houses across the street for $500,000. When you walk out your front door, are you still amazed by what you see, by the transformation that's happened?
You've done your homework. Yes, it's true. Yes, I am amazed. I'm also a little bewildered that houses can be that much, even though New Kensington has just built houses, Awesome Town. And I know that we sold those houses in the $400,000 range. And we were able to subsidize four houses with the money that we got from selling 10 of the houses. So we did 14 houses altogether. But it is a little bit hard to understand that houses can go for that much money in our neighborhood, you know. And most of my friends are equally, you know, disbelieving.
Does it still feel like home to you?
It does. It still feels like home. But again, I've lived in the same house for over 40 years. You know, the church, my church is still there. My school isn't. because it's combined with St. Laurentius, and so everybody goes to St. Laurentius now instead of Holy Name, but the church is still there. You know, a lot of my friends still live in the neighborhood, so I get to see them all the time. You know, some things have gotten better, some things have gotten worse, a lot of things have changed. But yeah, I still think it feels like home to me.
So a lot of your friends from your youth are still there. What do they, I mean, they know that you're a long timer, but you've also been encouraging new people to come into the neighborhood. Do they give you any pushback on that?
Oh, yeah. I think probably the worst was back when we were doing the fight with the casino. We weren't really doing, New Kensington was not fighting the casino. We were actually advocating for the special services district. But, you know, the neighborhood was in turmoil. There were half of the community that really wanted the casino and the other half of the community that thought this was going to be the death of the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And our organization decided not to take a stance, which was really difficult for me because I couldn't say anything, you know, simply because if I said anything, that would be what everybody assumed New Kensington's position was going to be. And so my family was all in favor of the casino, which is kind of funny because none of them have ever gone to the casino since it opened. But they were all in favor of it, and they didn't understand why it could have been a problem in the neighborhood.
They were excited. They saw it as a new development, a new opportunity, something exciting, relocating.
Yeah, they saw the economic opportunity that it was going to bring to the community. They didn't see the downside of the traffic and the crime and things of that nature that I'm happy to say has not happened, you know, but, you know, people were very concerned that it was going to happen.
So I want to talk about you for a few minutes. I know you talk a lot about your organization. I read that after working in the office of a textile factory, you eventually started volunteering with the Fishtown Civic Association. And this one article that I read about you called you an unlikely trailblazer, this housewife who started volunteering, who built up the NKCDC. How did you have the guts to go ahead and do that, to kind of jump into community activism and volunteering without having experience?
Well, my children were very young at the time. My daughter had just started second grade, and my son was in kindergarten. So I had time on my hands. And I knew that once he went to school, I was going to need to get a job, you know, because in this day and age, you just need to have two incomes. And if I wanted my kids to be able to do everything that I wanted them to do, the Catholic school, you know, the different arts groups and things of that nature, I needed to work. So I just, there was an article we had just put, it's kind of funny. There was this program that the Civic Association, Fishtown Civic Association, was doing with the Office of Housing and Community Development. It was a loan and grant program. And so we had just bought our house at the time, you know, and we needed to start fixing it up. So we put in for the program. And the Civic Association would send around flyers about how they needed help. And I thought, well, if I help, I'll be able to get my grant to be pushed through a little bit because it was taking forever. So that's what I did. By the time that my grant came up, I was already the executive director. It was a conflict of interest, and I wasn't able to get the loan or the grant. By that point, I had the job. So it was really kind of self-serving how I started to get into it. But as I got into it, I really began to love it. I loved being able to help people in our neighborhood. I loved being able to do, you know, the different programs. You know, we did one of the very first smoke detector programs in the country in Fishtown because we had had two horrendous fires where children died. You know, so that was something that was, you know, it was born out of tragedy, but it was something that was really, you know, helpful to so many people and to the city. You know, by that point, then the city's fire department took it over. And, you know, it's now they, every time there's a major fire, they go around and check to make sure that everybody has working smoke detectors because they're so important.
And I understand your desk at the New Kensington Community Development Corporation is decorated. You're putting your hand to your head. Is decorated with miniature pigs. Flying pigs. Why?
So a number of years ago, somebody was making a joke about how New Kensington makes pigs fly. And I just latched onto it. I thought, it's true. We do make things happen that everybody says is impossible. I mean, when we started doing all of this work on Frankfurt Avenue, it was because we had over 1,100 parcels of vacant land in our neighborhood. That's an area of a mile by a mile and a half. 1,100 parcels. Every single one of them was filled with trash. So that nobody wanted to move into our neighborhood. People in the neighborhood didn't want people to come visit them without sending them on all these weird circular paths because, you know, they didn't want them to see the trash. Frankfurt Avenue was a disgrace, and we would do cleanups, but, you know, it's really hard when you're dealing with Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, and senior citizens. It wasn't until we started the Land Use Management Program with Pennsylvania Horticultural Society that we were actually able to make a real change in the neighborhood, clean up the vacant lots, and give people the opportunity to see what this neighborhood really was and what it could be.
We're listening to Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler's interview with New Kensington CDC Executive Director Sandy Salzman, and that's a local housing and economic development group. We decided to spend the hour focusing on Fishtown, one of several neighborhoods that's been undergoing a big, even dramatic transformation in this city. Send us an email and tell us about your neighborhood, radiotimes@whyy.org. That's radiotimes@whyy.org. Philadelphia, like a lot of cities, has been an attractive place to live, a magnet for millennials, sometimes even their parents. But as we're hearing from Sandy Salzman, these changes are complicated and affect residents in different ways. She'll tell us more about her vision for Fishtown and other Philadelphia neighborhoods after this very short break. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. This hour, we've been exploring the Fishtown neighborhood's past and present with Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler.
I'm Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler, and my guest is Sandy Salzman, the executive director of the New Kensington Community Development Corporation. Was there ever a point during the last 40, 50 years when the trash, the vacant lots, drugs got to you and you considered moving out?
Oh, of course. I mean, my husband was from Fusterville. He didn't grow up in Philadelphia. Well, he grew up in his very young age, you know, but then he moved to Fusterville, I don't know, when he was around 12 or 13. He did not want to live in the city. However, what happened was, you know, we were spending all of our time in Fishtown, and by the time we decided to buy, he realized that it was not going to work to move to the suburbs because we would just be in Fishtown every weekend, everywhere, anyway, because that's where my family was, that's where my friends were, and now his friends, you know. So, but yeah, yeah, there's been a couple instances, but not serious.
And you mentioned the importance of affordable housing. I know that's really a vital piece, as you see it, of New Kensington CDC's work. And you mentioned all of the vacant lots. Are there any other things that you did over the last few decades to ensure that people, whether they be senior citizens who grew up there or lower and middle income families, could afford to stay, that would continue to be a neighborhood for families and middle-class families, that sort of thing? Anything else you've done that you're...
Well, I think that the work that our Economic Development Department is doing right now and has been doing has actually been really important to make it so that it's a place that people want to come to and want to stay in. I mean, when I was growing up and when my children were growing up, we had one restaurant in the neighborhood, one. It was at the corner of Frankfurt Avenue and Girard. It's where Joe's Steak is today. And, you know, you didn't have a choice. I mean, if you wanted to go out to breakfast or you wanted to go out to dinner in the neighborhood, that's where you went.
What was it called?
I can't remember.
It was a diner?
It was a diner. Mm-hmm. It was a Greek diner. And, you know, the people that worked there had been there forever. And then when they decided to sell, I mean, we had lots of steak places and pizza places and things of that nature. But that was the only place that you could go and sit down and have real food. Well, food.
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 And the Great Recession, I know, slowed down development in Fishtown as it did across the country. One thing that really surprised me was I read that you said that was a good thing, that development slowed. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I really do believe that it was a good thing because up until that point, there was a lot of development going on. And there were all of the, as they call them, hipsters that were moving into the neighborhood. And so the people that had been living there, you know, for a long time, they were really getting concerned. And the civic associations especially were feeling the stress because there would be a zoning meeting and all the hipsters would be on one side and the elderly residents or the old timers would be on the other side. And it became really difficult for the neighborhood. I think that when the recession hit, it slowed things down, not that development ever stopped, but it slowed it down enough. And a lot of the hipsters that had bought houses were now underwater, you know, so their houses weren't worth what they bought it for. If they bought their house for $30,000, it might be worth $250,000 or $200,000 because everything was cutting back. And I think that gave the residents in the neighborhood a chance to take a deep breath and to also feel sorry for these people that, you know, look what you did. I mean, you know, who knows whether it will all come back, you know. But most of them didn't put their houses up for sale. They didn't move. They stayed. They became a part of the community. And it gave everybody a chance to congeal and become, you know, a neighborhood and friendly. And, you know, I think that was really important. So for me, you know, I thought that that was a really important time in our development.
So when would you mark the beginning of gentrification in Fishtown? Was there an event or a year that sticks in your mind?
Probably in the early 2000s. It was when people started moving into the neighborhood. You know, 2002, 2003. We had started the land use management program in 1995. And so by 2003, we had started getting most of the vacant land cleaned up. People were looking at the neighborhood differently. A couple of developers were starting to buy properties and build them. You know, so I think that's when it started. And if, obviously, it's continued and it never really stopped, although it slowed down.
I was going to ask you the land use management program. So that's a part of NKCDC. Tell me what they do.
So the Land Use Management Program, these people are incredible. They work 5 days a week and they go out and they clean vacant lots. Not only in our neighborhood, we have contracts also in Kensington South and Norris Square, where they go out and they clean up the vacant land. They mow the grass. They make it look good. And they're out in temperatures that are crazy. I mean, this past week, you know, they have been gone through gallons and gallons of water, you know, but they're just an amazing crew. And they do this every day from April until probably November.
Why put so much effort into cleaning vacant lots?
Because it's what people see when they ride down the street. If you're riding down the street and you see a lot that's covered in grass, even if it's weeds, you know, but it's mowed and it's clean, you know, you look at it differently than you do if you're riding down the street and you're seeing tall weeds and trash because that feels threatening. A grass field doesn't feel threatening, you know, whereas, you know, dirty, filthy lots do. And it's also a place where, you know, when we had the big drug problems, it's a place where people can hide drugs, you know. So, you know, there's that.
And I know the neighborhood name Kensington is in New Kensington CDC's, obviously, in the moniker. But you're also working in some other neighborhoods further into Port Richmond, places mm-hmm. like that. Do you think that the success that NKCDC has had in Fishtown, can that serve as a model for other neighborhoods?
We believe it can. We have just started working north of Lehigh. So we are actually doing a project called the Orinoco Mills Civic House, and that's at Ruth and Somerset, which is right off of Kensington and Somerset Street, which at one time was the number one drug corner in the city of Philadelphia. We have been working very closely with the neighbors, with the police, with the district attorney, with SEPTA, to get this area cleaned up. We formed a civic association, and we are tackling the building, which will have 51 units of low moderate income housing, and New Kensington will be moving its offices there sometime next year.
And just in that one project you mentioned, I don't know, three or four city agencies, your organization, it sounds like this is quite complicated work.
It's very complicated, and there's even more agencies than that. We're also working with LISC, the Local Initiative Support Corporation, and Impact Services, and various churches, and the list goes on and on and on.
What do you think will happen in the next 20 years in Fishtown?
I think probably Fishtown, like many other neighborhoods, it will get into its groove, and it will not continue to get the spotlight that it gets now, which won't be a bad thing. I mean, you know, it's happened to Manayunk, it's happened to, you know, Old City. You know, it'll be a neighborhood, it'll be a nice neighborhood, it'll be a neighborhood people are happy with and proud of. But there's always got to be something new and unusual and happening. And so I believe that that will happen. I mean, right now, I think north of Lehigh is getting ready to take the spotlight.
It really does seem like Fishtown is maybe the Philadelphia neighborhood that has changed the most in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm. I believe it has, yes.
So what's next for you?
What's next for me? Well, I am retiring at the end of the year. And then I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to take a little bit of time off and try to figure that out, and then I'll pop up someplace, I'm sure.
I'm Elizabeth Fiedler, and my guest has been Sandy Salzman, the executive director of the New Kensington Community Development Corporation. Sandy, thanks so much for joining me.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times. As we were putting the show together, an article published a few years ago in Philadelphia Magazine caught our attention. The headline of the 2014 piece said it all. Confession, I'm black, and I used to be afraid to walk around Fishtown. Producer Elizabeth Fiedler sat down with the author Sandy Smith, an editor at the magazine, to get a glimpse into the experiences that prompted him to write the article.
Sandy, thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Your 2014 article in Philadelphia Magazine was called Confession, I'm Black and I Used to be Afraid to Walk Around Fishtown. I'd like you to read a passage from your article, if you could go ahead.
Like most black Philadelphians, I had heard stories about Fishtown. It seemed that we weren't welcome there. I'd read stories about blacks getting harassed, and worse, when they moved into the neighborhood. And I wasn't alone. Journalist Bobby Booker, who came of age in South Philly during the years of racial strife in the 1970s and 80s, had a similar recollection of the place. There were areas of the region I was disallowed to traverse because of my race, and Fishtown was notorious for those restrictions, she said. And it wasn't just black folk. The disallowed included gays and any non-Irish. Because of my gender, I had a pass of sorts, and was able to tensely travel in and through Fishtown in the years mentioned above.
You start by saying that after living in the city for decades, you'd visited every neighborhood except for one, Fishtown. Why did it take so long for you to get there?
Its reputation preceded it. I've only lived in three cities, but whenever I spend any significant amount of time in a city, my attitude is the whole city's my oyster. You know, I want to explore every inch of it. I want to travel anywhere, you know, and take me, walk around, explore the neighborhoods or something. But I came here from Boston. I got down here and I'd read stories about black families moving into Fishtown and having bricks thrown through their windows, other tales like that. And it kind of dawned on me that it would probably be wise if I avoided that neighborhood as well.
And you did.
And I did. For many, many years.
I was looking back at a few articles that were published in the Philadelphia Inquirer, one in 1994, one in 1988, really describing these brutal attacks, race-based attacks. One, the headline is, "Two men held in beatings, racism blamed in Fishtown." One about a brick being thrown in Fishtown. You mentioned that there were these incidents that happened and that people were talking about them. It sounds like it really stoked fear. It made people quite afraid at the time.
I would say so. I mean, you know, it wasn't necessarily like it was a subject of conversation among all my friends and acquaintances, but it was very much, you know, in our consciousness. I didn't know anybody at the time who lived in Fishtown, worked in Fishtown, or visited Fishtown. That's changed now. One of the things I'm inclined to believe as a result of what I've seen in the years since is that, you know, a few bad apples can ruin things for everybody. It probably was then, as it seems to me now, that most of the people in Fishtown are decent working folk who don't really want to, you know, make life difficult for anybody else.
Are you afraid to walk around Fishtown now, still?
Hell no. I like walking around Fishtown. It is actually a very charming neighborhood. It's got a very tight-knit character. The housing stock is very solid. The Fishtowners who've always, like, believed in the place regardless, they seem to have the upper hand now. And while some people insist that I may have been giving the newcomers too much credit, I think their influx helped. Their lack of the ingrained attitudes, their, you know, their unfamiliarity with the history probably helped change the whole tenor so that the good people could broaden their net and bring in more people who are interested in making Fishtown as lively, as vibrant, as pleasant as it can be.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I guess the one thing I'd like to add is I hope they can figure out a way to keep the neighborhood affordable. I mean, like many other neighborhoods that have become popular, development pressures seem to be raising the cost of housing. And, you know, I happen to think that neighborhoods that are diverse in an income sense are also stronger. We have a tendency not to like those kinds of neighborhoods. They're very few and far between. Germantown is one of the few I know of. Fishtown could be too, if the Fishtowners seize the moment.
I'm Elizabeth Fiedler, a producer for Radio Times, and my guest has been Sandy Smith, an editor at Philadelphia Magazine. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me in.
And that's our portrait of Fishtown, one of Philadelphia's changing neighborhoods, produced by Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler. For more information about Radio Times, go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for the newsletter. You can also listen to us on satellite radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Radio Times producers Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, Liz Fiedler, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.